Welcome back in everyone to a fabulous new Whisper in the Wings from Stage Whisper. We have a fabulous new show to be sharing with you today. Truly a perfect show for the summer. And joining us today, we have the producer Jonathan Hogue and the playwright Fernando Segal. They are joining us to talk about their show, The World's Most Boring Murder. It's playing July 11th through the 28th at the Players Theater, and you can get your tickets and more information by visiting theplayerstheater.com. We are very excited to have these two here. Of course, we cannot wait to dive into the show. So let's go ahead and welcome on our guests, Jonathan, Fernando. Welcome onto Whisper in the Wings from Stage Whisper.
Hey, hey, thanks for having us.
Hey, it's great to be here.
I'm so happy you both are here. I can't wait to dive into this hard-hitting drama that you're bringing to us. Fernando, why don't we start with you as a playwright? Can you tell us a little bit about this great show, The World's Most Boring Murder?
Absolutely. So our show is a comedy, or a farce, really. It draws heavy inspirations of comedy dell'arte, but also Brazilian clown traditions. I am from Brazil. I was born and raised there, though I've been here for about 8 years now. And at some point in Brazil, for about 2 years, I was part of a traveling troupe of clowns that traveled up and down the country performing clown shows with like minimum requirements, sometimes on the street, sometimes to people who never saw theater. And I think that is a big force behind my writing, or at least my writing style, I think. And this play is the greatest example of that. This is a play that, in my mind, could easily be done in a sidewalk in Brazil if need be, or in a sidewalk in New York, or in a theater in New York. Anything is possible. There are no real character requirements. There's no almost no set requirements. Though, of course, we do have a set and we have props. That's not specifically required to do the show. And it's just five very funny and very engaging actors doing their best to make an audience laugh. Though I will say that I recently graduated from Columbia's MFA playwriting program. And the greatest compliment that I've ever had was from one of my professors, who said that my writing style was called hiding the veggies, which is you make the audience laugh a lot and feel like they are just eating fast food and having a good time, but they don't know that there's actually a nutritious meal hidden behind the fast food, and you're eating some vegetables along with your meal. And that's what I try to do, I would say. I try to make shows that are very, very funny and very, very ridiculous, but that in the end you realize that there's actually something being communicated there, and there's actually something that I'm trying to say, or a message that's trying to be told, or almost like a fable in a way, I would say. And this play is a good example of that. I want the audience to laugh all the way when they're in the show, but then on the way back, they suddenly realize they have something to talk about.
I love that. I'm going to have to steal that description. Hiding the veggies, that is so brilliant. And I love that that's a great way to describe your writing in this show, because I think one of the best ways to get a idea or a message to an audience is through comedy, is through laughter, because it disarms them. It lets their guard, it makes them let their guard down. And then, you know, they leave and they go, oh, apparently I've absorbed this idea and I had no idea, you know? So I really love that about this show. This is exciting. So where exactly did you come up with the idea to pen this piece?
So the play, which I talked so much about it, but I didn't say anything about the setup. Basically, it takes place in a very small town, fictitious small town, where no crime has ever happened before. And the protagonist of the story is the police inspector in this town. And they are middle-aged and very, very, very bored. And they just don't want to be around anymore, because they became a police inspector because they wanted to be Sherlock Holmes or a big detective. And now for 30 years, they've been in this town and nothing has happened. And the crimes he has to deal with is like people stealing each other's bread, or like neighbors bickering. And that's everything he's ever done in his life. And when the play starts, a very, very gruesome murder has just taken place for the first time in the town's history. But for the police inspector, this is the best thing that could have possibly happened. It's like they're having the time of their lives because they finally have something to do. So the play is about the police inspector and their two unhelpful assistants, who also have no experience in solving crimes. One of them is really based out of Lucky from Waiting for Godot. So they never speak almost. They have like three or four. They are always on stage, but they have about four or five lines. So it's a very clown kind of character. And then you have two other actors who play about half a dozen characters each. So they play a bunch of different parts, playing all different people in the town who are being investigated as they search for the serial for the killer. But the thing is that the longer they take to find the killer, they might eventually become a serial killer, which the dilemma is that a good thing or a bad thing for a police inspector? Like, the more people die, the more he has to do with their lives. And my inspiration to writing this play was, it's actually based on the very first thing that I ever wrote, which was a one act I wrote about 7 or 6 years ago. I wrote it completely by accident. I was applying for colleges for undergrad, and I applied to Ithaca College. And by accident, I applied to be to the theater program, but not as an actor. They have a program that's like either playwriting or director. And it was completely by accident. I had to write something to finish the application. I had already paid the application process. So I was like, I might as well write a short play. And I wrote it and sent it to them. And it was this. And it was loosely based on this Brazilian play that I love that is called O Bem Amado. I don't think it exists in English. I don't think it, though I would love to translate it one day, but I don't think it exists in English. And it's about this small town and this mayor that gets elected in the small town by telling everyone that he's going to build their very first cemetery. And he gets elected, he gets a lot of money, he builds the home, the first cemetery. But then people stop dying in this town. And for 3 or 4 years, he can't inaugurate the cemetery. And people start hating him because he spent all the town's money opening up this thing and no one dies. So there's no use for it. And that was my inspiration, which was kind of like the value of that, or like when does that becomes almost like a commodity kind of a thing, which is what really made me start thinking about this show. And then about 2 years ago, I was part of a theater festival at the Theater of Western Springs, which is in a suburb in Chicago. And the one act, the original one act, was produced in it. And it was about 30 minutes long, and it was very successful there. It seemed like people really, really enjoyed it, which made me think I should maybe turn this into a full thing, a full play. And I kept working on it for this past 2 years, making different drafts. I was doing my program at Columbia, as I mentioned, so I had a great place to experiment and to workshop the play and to try things out with great professors and great classmates. And that's how I got to this funny little piece that I have today. Though I should say, we also have an absolutely incredible director named Patrick Swayze-Caldwell, who's just, they made the show into something else also. It's like, nothing makes a show as the right director, and we definitely have the right director who was able to really open up the show and like find all these things that I myself, or like even draft after draft, there are things that cannot be found unless you're in the rehearsal room with the right people.
That is incredible. I love all of that. This is so exciting. I love this kind of comedy. This is my kind of comedy. It's just border slapstick, but it's also just really smart and witty. This is fabulous. So, Jonathan, let's bring you into the conversation now. Of course, you are the producer of the show. I would love to know, how did you come upon this piece?
So Fernando and I met in the Columbia MFA program. So I was in the producing and management track, and Fernando was in the playwriting track. And part of the program is that you have these thesis productions that you're part of. And Fernando had produced a couple of his works at Columbia. He and I have been friends for a couple of years here now. But he had this show coming up as his thesis production at Columbia, and asked me to produce it. And of course, I said, send me the script. Like, I'm your friend, but I'm not necessarily gonna produce it unless I love it. And I read it and I was like, oh no, I'm producing this. Okay. And it was totally up my alley. It was like, it felt very much in the world of like 39 Steps and Peter and the Starcatcher, where it's like people switching hats and wigs. And I'm the writer and producer of Stranger Sings, the parody musical that was off Broadway last season. And so this is very much in the same vein of, people double cast, and it's scrappy and it's clever and it's creative. And there's actors creating things with simple props to, like, suddenly it's a door and suddenly they're holding up a mirror and they're part of the set. It's just stuff like that that it has that electricity that I love in theater. So anyway, so we did it at we produced it at Columbia for the thesis presentations, and it went really well. We sold out, we had great response, and then ended up transferring this now to the Players Theater for this longer run, where we're able to take a little more time to kind of develop some of the story beats and some of the script moments. And we have new actors, and we have more time to kind of stage it and light it and costumes and stuff. And So yeah, so it's really fun. It's just a silly, stupid, good time, and has heart. And so yeah, I'm very proud of it.
As you should be. That is amazing. Now, Jonathan, let me ask. I mean, we are just under a week away from the show beginning performances at the Players Theater. What has it been like developing this fabulous show?
Yeah, no, it's been fun because with this run, we have more time, with the director. We have a couple new actors, and so we're finding more in the rehearsal room that I think we didn't have as much time to do at Columbia. And so it's exciting because not only do we have that time, but we have more time for audiences to discover the show too. We're in a very intimate space. It's 50 seats per show, so it's very limited seating, very limited tickets. So a huge part of my work as a producer is getting people to see it and then talk about it, because once people hear about how great it is and they have this great experience, those tickets are going to go flying off the shelves, So, but yeah, I'm very proud of it. It's very fun to get to dive deeper into comedy, because I just think, with my experience with Stranger Things, it's like the more time you have, the more little nuggets you find within the script. And it's comedy is such a it's such a intricate thing, because it's the writing, but it's also the acting in the performances and what the performers bring to it. But then it sometimes is also the lighting has to like hit something right, and the sound design has to be a feeling, and the costumes accentuate certain beats, and the props have to look a certain. So there's just all these little pieces of comedy that when they come together perfectly, it just makes this golden experience. But it takes time to kind of find some of those nuances. And like, I again, from Stranger Things experience, like every time we got to do it again, it just got funnier and funnier and funnier, because we find, oh, that works. Oh, that's what this is. That's what that moment needs to be. And so that's what we're finding with the show. Fernando, do you want to say more? Because I know you're literally rewriting the show as you're working
Yeah,
on it, so.
I absolutely agree with you. I always say this thing that I think that Brazilian theater makers often say in the US, which is that what Americans call device theater, Brazilians just call theater. And a believer in that, I don't think that's always the case, but I feel like with comedies, and me specifically as a playwright with comedies, I think it's very important to have a very collaborative and open space for suggestions and things like that with the cast and the director. And I told that from the start that, like, in a comedy like that, it's like I am not precious with my words at all, especially because, as I mentioned, I really trust my director, and I really trust my cast members. So that has been great, opening up space for seeing new things and new jokes and new moments that come into the play. And it's been very, very revealing that we keep working on bits. They're amazing. So I add them to the actual page. And I'm like, I want every production of the show to always do this, that was discovered between the actors. And that keeps happening over and over and over again. We, as Jonathan mentioned, had the chance to do three performances at Columbia. It was a way more fast-paced environment where no one was really getting paid and everyone was working as much as they could. So that was that and that too, which was tough. We were able to also discover a lot of things in that process, and now we have this privilege to bring the show back after getting feedback from, again, all my professors and all my classmates. So we were able to really listen to what was good and what's not good. In fact, we cut about 20 minutes of the play because a big thing was like it feels too long. The play needs to it was 1 hour and 50 minutes long, which for me was did not work, and I really thought it had to be 1.5 hours. So we really worked on that and finding those moments and making the play happen so fast. And that was something that we really realized. The pace right now is very the quick comedy pace that needs to be, and they need so much rehearsal to get to that place where the actors are comfortable to just do their thing in a quick way that's also still very engaging and very fun and so precise with what they are doing. And I'm very happy that we got to that place now.
That is wonderful. I love all of that. This sounds like the perfect textbook example of good comedy writing right now. Like that, yes. Amen. So, Fernando, sticking with you for this next question, I'm curious to know, obviously, you're the playwright. So, is there a message or a thought you hope that audiences take away from your piece?
Yes, I'm not gonna talk too much about it because, as I mentioned, they are the vegetables that are hidden in the meal. And that truly, I am very interested in the theatrical effect, so to speak, which is when you have a show that is mostly one thing and then it really becomes something else for this moments or for its ending or whatever. I feel like there are lots of plays that we say pull the rug from under the audience, so to speak, but more than just in a plot way, in a really like a tone way, even or style way. Like, I think Fairview is a great example of that, which is a show that I absolutely love that just completely changes right in front of you and becomes something completely different. I'm not nearly that bold, but we do have a big tone shift for a moment in the play, which is when suddenly the audience should be realizing that some of the things they've been laughing at are not supposed to be that funny. It's almost British theater, Marty McDonagh style of doing things, which is the audience is laughing at this horrible, horrible thing. And then they should be like, why am I laughing at this absolutely terrible thing? And the effect that that causes in an audience member, I'm really interested in that. So there is definitely something that I'm trying to communicate or a message that I'm trying to relay on that I'm not going to just say it, but it definitely deals with the place of police enforcement in a society, and the value of individuality in a society, which, you know, such broad themes that I'm just saying there. And we do try to talk about that in a much more specific way to make an audience wonder about that. The place of comedy in a society and who we laugh at and who we don't laugh at. We've been really, really heavily on the clown aspects of the play for Columbia. We actually use clown noses for some of the actors, which we're not doing anymore because we found something else that we wanted to explore. But there is something interesting in that, the place of the clown in a society and things like that. That's definitely all things that I want to explore. But as of right now, all I can say to people coming to see the show is like, no, you're just going to have a good time. You're just going to laugh and have fun. Because then when that stops happening, I'm hoping the effect takes place and the rug gets pulled.
I love it. That is exactly what popped in my mind. The more and more we talk about the show, I'm like, this just sounds fun. Jonathan, is there anything you'd like to add to those ideas?
Yeah, I think what's special about, I mean, you know, for my own, both Fernando and I see so much theater. We usually are each other's theater buddies too. So we see a lot of different shows. And I think both of us, what resonates is the stuff that is able to have a certain, you know, takeaway from it, that it doesn't feel light and fluffy, but it also doesn't feel so heavy that you kind of, it takes you down with it, you know? And I feel that like a really good comedy is hard to pull off. I mean, I've seen a lot of shows where it's really funny for the first 30 minutes and then it just loses steam entirely. And then suddenly by the end, you're kind of exhausted, you know? And I think what makes a good comedy work is having that mix of really intelligent writing with really intelligent acting and physical choices. Because if the whole thing is slapstick for 90 minutes, it can get exhausting. But what Fernando's written, which I love, is that it's a really witty, clever wordplay script that has slapstick elements. So you're laughing at different types of things throughout the show without just laughing at funny bit, funny bit, funny bit. You know what I mean? So that's what's fun to me, is that it has that rhythm that allows you to kind of stay with it all the way through. And it's a surprise box. It's got these moments where you're like, oh my gosh, wait, this person's playing this character now. And now there's this whole bit with this character, and you know, these characters come back. And it's just it's fun, because the more you dive into the world that Fernando's created, the more it just kind of continues to surprise you and come up with new things to get you laughing, and yeah, it's a lot of fun. So
I love it. Yes, if anything you take away, listeners, the show is fun. This is great.
And I'll just compliment that by saying that we have the benefit of having the murder mystery aspect of it in the comedy too, which is, I guess, it's a whole genre now to have. Not now, it's been for couple decades now, but murder mysteries, there are comedies, though those are common, those exist. But I find that those are especially interesting because you have, Jonathan mentioned the twists, and that is, it comes from that genre. I feel like it's hard to have sometimes comedies that have that many plot twists and things like that. But when writing this play, I'm a huge research guy. I think that doing research is a very important thing, but it's also something that I really, really enjoy doing. And when I was going to write this play, the first thing that I did was just research plain murder mysteries first, like the classical things, or things like Columbo, or things like, you know, classic plays and classic movies, and Sherlock Holmes and Agatha Christie. And then after that, I went to the second level, which is the spoofs, like things like Clue and Murder by Death and Arsenic and Lovelace, things like that take a spin on the genre. And I do find that they are most successful when they are able to have the structure of a murder mystery, which is like very, very, very specific and full of twists and very intricate, while having comedy throughout, which is, I think it's a very, very useful device because the audience always want to know what's going to happen next and never get that, which sometimes can happen at show, at comedies, which is, it's really funny, but I don't know if something is really happening or if we're going somewhere, like if the story is moving with the comedy, which I think is the toughest part, which is balancing out the plot with the jokes. And when do you have too many jokes, which is mostly my problem at times. Again, I was really lucky to have my director, because when I was working on the play at Columbia, a comment that I often heard from people was, you have a lot of jokes. You should find the jokes that you need, the jokes that you don't need. And my director, Patrick, was the opposite. They were like, there's no such thing as too many jokes. Like, you can have as many jokes as you want. So we're able to find that the balance between having as many jokes as we want, but also not do knowing when the plot needs to be bigger and the jokes need to settle down a little, and find that perfect balance, which I do think we were able to do. And now we have this show that, yeah, it has a lot of plot twists in it too, as a murder mysteries. I do hope we try our best, but you should not figure out who the killer is throughout the play until the very last 15 minutes or so. And those are all also cool parts of the play that I'm excited for people to see.
That is wonderful. Fantastic. Loving this. Jonathan, I want to pass my final question for this first part on to you. And that is, who are you hoping have access to the world's most boring murder?
The great thing is we're at the Players Theater, which is literally on the same street as the Comedy Cellar and, you know, the Blue Note and all these really great venues. And I think what's fun is that there are audiences who are already in that area for entertainment, and especially for comedy, with the Comedy Cellar right next door. And so I'm hoping that, you know, being in that space where people are already looking for a good laugh, that they take a chance on our show, which might be, you know, new to them, but it's right there. And it's the perfect show for, you know, 90 minutes of nonstop laughter and surprises and storytelling. And so, yeah, so I hope it's, you know, young audiences that maybe don't go to theater a lot, maybe do go to the comedy scene and look for something new. I think this is the perfect show for them, and we're in the right spot for them too.
The second part of our show, we love giving our listeners a chance to get to know our guests a little bit better. Pick your brains, if you will. And I want to start by asking the two of you, what or who inspires you? What playwrights, composers, or shows have inspired you in the past, or are just some of your favorites? And Jonathan, can I actually start the second part with you?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it depends on, I have so many. It depends on what avenue or what hat I'm wearing, I guess. No, I mean, you know, I'm a writer and a producer. So I think as a writer, my comedy sensibilities, I grew up on Saturday Night Live, Monty Python, The Simpsons, Starkid, you know, just like satire is so like in my blood and in my taste and my style. Just love being able to like take something that's familiar and then subvert it, you know? Like, I love that kind of theater, even if it's not a parody per se. Like, what Fernando's written is so fun because it's subverting the murder mystery genre while also being a murder mystery at the same time. So that's fun. So those are big inspirations. You know, I also love like Annie Baker, Brandy Jacobs Jenkins, Lucas Neath, Jackie Sibley's Drury. Those are some of those playwrights that I will go see anything they do. Yeah, I love storytelling that both captures real life and also, yeah, and also is subversive and finds a new surprise to something that feels familiar. So, and I love dark comedy. I just think dark comedy is a lot of fun, so.
I love that list. That is a fabulous list. Some of my favorites on there as well. Fernando, what about you? What or who inspires you?
Yeah, so as Jonathan mentioned, we see a lot of theater, and I have a problem, which is not really a problem, but for some people might be a problem, which is that I mostly like what I see. It's very hard for me to see something that I don't know, I really love theater, and it's very hard for me to see a show that there's not at least something for me to get out of it, or like the moments that I enjoy. So when it comes to what I like, Unfortunately, it's impossible for me to list all the things that I like, because I like a lot different kinds of theater and different playwrights and different directors that work today. Big inspirations for me growing up in Brazil, as I was preparing to come here with my New York theater dreams, like many people around the world has. The content I had never been to the US before, and American theater rarely makes its way to Brazil in translations or in productions. Brazilians really are not about, they're like the Yankees and the capitalists, and we don't want that stuff. So they really are not about American theater. But the way that I had to connect with it was mostly through reading. So I spent a lot of high school reading European and American theater, thinking that I was getting ready to come here. And in this journey, I definitely found the playwrights that I feel like really, really shaped me. People like Harold Pinter is someone who it's a lot of people don't find funny, but I find him remarkably funny. And it's crazy. I remember I always think about that. I was like 17 and all the way in Brazil reading Pinter by myself and having the best time. And when I say this to people here, they're like, "What is wrong with you? Why would a 17-year-old enjoy reading Pinter?" But I did. And people like Marty McDonagh, people like Carol Churchill, people like big European playwrights like Ionesco and Pirandello, Rhinoceros is definitely something that I feel like anything you see that I write, an audience member can be like, "You read Rhinoceros. You very clearly have read Rhinoceros." And yes, I love Rhinoceros, and it's all over everything that I write. So these are definitely all really big inspirations. But also, I was able to, these past 2 years, I've been working on and off as a Sandy Rusin's assistant, who is this incredible playwright that mostly writes comedy. She wrote the stage adaptation of The Clue film, which I just mentioned was a reference for me, that's really popular right now. And she wrote The Cottage, which was on Broadway last season too. And she's a big, big person when it comes to the comeback of comedy, the importance of farce in the world, which is something that you never, never see. Like New York theater today, it's so, so rare to see a farce. Not even big places like Broadway, where it's really rare, but anywhere in off Broadway is really hard to just see plays that are trying to be these really well-written comedies and really funny comedies. And she has been a huge influence for me as an artist and as a playwright, for sure. And just the idea of bringing back farces and the power of farces, that not just as an entertainment, but what it communicates. So all those people, they usually like write these plays that are trying to be really funny, but also trying to be meaningful and have their place in the world, and plays that can be done anywhere, like Rhinoceros, which can be done in any country at any point. Or plays like The Visit was also a really big influence. Some Beckett plays, all these stuff is like, yes, theater that can be done anywhere, accessible to anyone, funny to anyone, and communicate something at the same time. Those are all big influences.
I love that. Another incredible list. That's fantastic. I love both of your inspirations. This is so wonderful. And that leads to my favorite question to ask guests. And that, of course, is what is your favorite theater memory?
I have one, and it's impossible to pick a favorite because I have so many, but I think the one that jumped to mind was I happened to get tickets last minute to see the performance of Company, the recent revival, the first preview following COVID. And I'd never seen Company before, but I knew the music, and I'd always want to see a professional production. And so I kind of wasn't sure if I wanted to go or not. I was excited to see it, but I wasn't necessarily dying to be at the first performance. And then, they were building up to first performance, and I was like, "Oh gosh, I want to see this." And so I casually one morning looked to see if they had any tickets left for the first preview, and they had two tickets in the rear mezz, and I was like, "I should go. I should go." And so I bought two tickets and got in the theater, and they had all this like they had like party hats for everyone, and they had little tote bags and stickers that said first preview. But and it was post-COVID, so everyone was they had done a couple of weeks or a couple of performances of previews before COVID shut them down. So it was this big grand return. And I'll never forget, they brought the lights came down, they brought before the show started, Marianne Elliott came out on stage with a mic and just said, "Hey, thank you so much for being here. This is so meaningful. We're back from COVID. Like, we're so grateful to share the show with you. And before we do, I want to introduce you to the cast of Company." They raise the curtain, the whole cast is standing there, everyone's standing ovation, just freaking out, so excited, cheering them on before the show's even started. And then Patti LuPone steps forward and gets huge applause and whatnot. And she takes a microphone and she comes out and she says, "I want to dedicate this performance to Stephen Sondheim." And she gestures to Stephen Sondheim sitting in like the fifth row orchestra. This is 2 weeks before he passed away, and he was there. And it was just the whole room went nuts, and it was so like surreal and emotional to be in the room watching his show with him. And of course, then the show was just incredible. I had like seven standing ovations during the show. Like Ladies Who Lunch probably had like a 5 minute standing ovation. It was just insane. I'd never seen a show like that. And then we came out of the show and there was like 1,000 balloons in the street because it's, the birthday theme from the show. And it was magical. And then 2 weeks later he passed away. And it was so like, I can't believe I got to be in the room with him, right before that moment. So anyway, so that was, and I just loved that revival, and I just thought it was so well done. And yeah, that was a really, really cool night in the theater. But I've had many of those, so I feel very lucky to have more memories beyond that one too. So
I love that. What an amazing memory. What an amazing memory. Thank you for sharing that. Fernando, what about you? What is your favorite theater memory?
again, I second that there are definitely many. As I mentioned, seeing Fairview was definitely a very impactful experience to me. And as a play that you can read it, but seeing it is half of the show. There's no way around it. But an experience that I often think about and I often talk about was that when I first came to New York, again, I had read a lot of theater, but I hadn't really seen a lot of it. And there was a day, I think I was here for about a couple months. I lived close to the Public Theater, and at the time they had lottery tickets at Today Tix that I would always try to get. And on one Wednesday, which for some reason I did not have class on that Wednesday, I don't know why, but I got lottery tickets to see Plenty. That they would have Plenty Matinee and Leonard Just Sweat at night on the same day. And I had at that point I probably have seen like two or four plays. I don't know. I really was recent here, and it was just a lovely day of theater, as one would expect. But especially the performance of Sweat was something that was really, really impactful to me as an audience member, as a writer, as everything. I remember my reaction to it was in part that I wrote my first full-length play, which was a terrible play in a bar no one will ever read. But it was still just a visceral reaction to seeing that show. And also, I think Trump had won the election something like 3 or 4 days before. So because of that, after the play, there was like a big talk back to talk about, Sweat is a play that deals about like why do people vote for Trump, like who are the people that do this in a very interesting way. And there was just this kind of community feeling to it at the Public with the talk back to the artists that all I could think of is I want to be a part of this. Like I want to find a way to be a in any way, shape, or form a part of this community or a part of this thing that seems so important. It seemed so engaging and so interesting and so important to be there. And it only became more meaningful to me because I had an immense, huge privilege of learning under Lynn, because she's the main teacher and the main professor at Columbia. And she's also just the most wonderful person. And she gave me the opportunity to translate her work to Portuguese, and her work does not wor exist in Brazil. And the first play that I have translated is Sweat, and it's going to be published in a couple months in Brazil, and it's going to be the first full-length play that I have published. So it's a translation, obviously, it's not my play. Lynn did all the hard lifting, but it's crazy to me that it almost seemed like not destiny, but it does seem like something that after all these years, from 8 years after I saw the show, and it was the thing that almost made me want to do theater, it's still a play that's so important to me and so meaningful to me. But yeah, I became a huge Public Theater fan. I oftentimes say the Public Theater is like almost like a second home to me, and a lot of it is just because of this one day where I saw 6 hours worth of theater, probably. And yeah, and felt like I was part of something bigger, and felt like I was part of this people that had meaningful things to do, say, and meaningful things to do, and supported each other and helped each other. That was it. That was the thing that really made me a theater person.
That is amazing. Congratulations on the translation, but also just what amazing memories right there. Both of you, what great memories. Thank you both so much for those. That's wow. Wow. Well, as we wrap things up, I would love to know, do either of you have any other projects or productions coming down the pipeline we might be able to plug for you?
Yeah, I'm producing a new musical at the Tank Theater in the fall, or the Tank, I think is the would be the name. It's called Gollum Owned a Tropical Smoothie. It's a musical about Gollum from Lord of the Rings, who owns a smoothie shop in Panama City Beach, Florida. And he basically it's such a weird show, and I love it so much. It's basically about these three young adults who work at the smoothie shop, or two young adults who work at the smoothie shop. This kid who basically has moved to Panama City Beach, and he doesn't really know what he wants to do with his life. And his sister is kind of taking care of him because their parents have left. And so it's really these three young adults that are kind of trying to figure out who they are in the world. And their boss happens to be Gollum. And there's this evil overlord of all these smoothie shops named Smeagol, which is the same puppet, but a different wig. And basically, Smeagol is trying to shut down all of the tropical smoothies in the area to take over as the Smoothie Kingdom, which is the big kind of corporate overlord there. And so anyway, so poor Gollum and his shop are getting shut down. And so these three young adults realize they find their purpose in trying to save the smoothie shop. And in turn, the whole piece is really just about, you know, what do you do? With how do you make sense of a world that doesn't make sense? You know, there's like, why does Gollum own a tropical smoothie? No one really knows, but he does, and that's what matters. And it's a very funny show. It's got lots of puppets, it's got humans as well, but it's incredible music, and the two guys who wrote it play the Gollum puppets, so they're like in the show as well, and it's got lots of subversive humor and, you know, pulling back the curtain, and, you know, it's really fun. So that's coming up in October. And yeah, some other stuff in the pipeline that I probably can't talk about yet, but, you know, I'm a producer on Queen of Versailles with Kristen Chenoweth in Boston this summer, a co-producer. And so that'll be fun coming up. Yeah. More to come. We'll see. Fernando.
Yeah, I definitely have lots of things that I am working on. And when it comes to the near future, I recently was part of the Valdez Theater Conference, and I had a full-length play read there, which is very much so in the style of this play. So a big farce, even bigger, because it just has so many parts in it. But it's a farce with a backing a punch or trying to communicate something and all that. And some of the readings in Valdez are going to be brought to New York, I heard. They are bringing about five of them to do it here. And my play is one of them. And so and that's coming in about 2 months. I'm not sure the exact date yet, but that's something that's going to happen. And I'm really excited for. I am really not an actor, though I went to undergrad for acting at NYU. That was an experience that mostly made me realize that I was not as much of an actor as some of my classmates that really, really wanted to do that. And I realized more and more that I really, really wanted to be a writer more than an actor. But about 2 years ago, I was in a French-Brazilian movie in Brazil, mostly because my older brother was a screenwriter in it and seemed like something fun to do. And all my scenes were like with this incredible Brazilian actress that has a Palme d'Or and it's like this huge person. I was like, sure, I would do that. I just want to be in a room with her. And the movie's coming out soon. It's coming out in September. It's called, I'm a supporting role, but a good supporting role in it. And it is coming to the US too. I don't know the exact date yet, but it's called Madame du Rocher. And it's the real story about the first woman to be a doctor in Brazil in the 19th century Brazil. And she's like 18th century Brazil. And she's like, French immigrant. It's a really cool story. And that's coming out in September, probably. If you hear about a French Brazilian movie coming to New York or something, yeah, it should be this one. That's probably not sure, though.
That is amazing. Amazing. So you both have some really amazing stuff in the fire that we need to keep tabs on. And that is a great lead into my final question, which is if our listeners would like more information about the world's most boring murder or about either of you, maybe they'd like to reach out to you. How can they do so?
Yeah, we're on Instagram and TikTok at Most Boring Murder. You can follow us there for updates. We'll, you know, we've got lots of little things we'll be tossing out to our audiences and fans there. And I'm on Instagram as well. You can find me at JTHOGUE2, JTHOGUE2 on Instagram and Twitter and TikTok, even though I don't really post on TikTok very much. And then my website is jonathanhogue.com if anybody wants to follow that as well. So
you can definitely find me on all the social medias with my name. I if you just look up Fernando Segal, you'll probably find me, but you can also look for my writer's name, which is Fernando Pulsar Segal. I use my mom and my dad's last name for that because I think it's cool. I don't know. But you can easily find me that way. You can find me on New Play Exchange, which I think is something that all playwrights look into. It's a really good program. And if you want to see more of my work, there you can find both the play that was read about these, and we'll have a reading soon is there, and also a full-length play that I wrote that's about Brazilian immigration, and it's not really that funny. But at Jack last year, and had a few performances at Jack last summer, and you can find that too if that interests anyone. And yeah, that's probably the main outlets to see what I'm up to.
Well, wonderful. Well, Jonathan, Fernando, thank you both so much for taking the time to speak with me today, for sharing this amazing, amazing and fun show. I cannot wait to see it. So thank you both so much for your time.
course. Can't wait to have you there.
Absolutely. Thank you.
My guests today have been the incredible artist, the producer Jonathan Hogue, and the playwright Fernando Segal, who joined us to talk about their exciting new work, The World's Most Boring Murder. It's playing July 11th through the 28th at the Players Theater, and you can get your tickets and more information by visiting theplayerstheater.com. We also have some contact information for our guests, which we'll be posting on our episode description as well as on our social media posts, but you need to run. Don't walk. Head to theplayerstheater.com. Get your tickets now. You will not be disappointed with this show. This is a perfect summer show. It's a great comedy. We're going to be there, so let's come on out and make it a stage whisper night out at the theater. Again, the show is called The World's Most Boring Murder, and it's playing July 11th through the 28th. So until next time, I'm Andrew Cortez, reminding you to turn off your cell phones, unwrap your candies,
and keep talking about the theater
in a stage whisper.
Thank you.
If you like what you hear, please leave a 5-star review, like, and subscribe.
You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram at Stage Whisper Pod.
And feel free to reach out to us with your comments and personal stories at stagewhisperpod@gmail.com.
And be sure to check out our website for all things Stage Whisper and theater. You'll be able to find merchandise, tours, tickets, and more. Simply visit stagewhisperpod.com. Our theme song is Maniac by Jazzar. Other music on this episode provided by Jazzar and Billy Murray. You can also become a patron of our show by logging on to patreon.com/stagewhisperpod. There you will find all the information about our backstage pass as well as our tip jar. Thank you so much for your generosity. We could not do this show without you.